I've been interested in the field since I was 39. And I've been 39 for 20 years. I am 4 months, I guess, or something from being 60 years old. And there are certain great privileges that come when you get to be 60. There's a lot of a lot of people, of course. Boy, I hate to get old, but I always remind them of the alternative. And when you consider the alternatives, which I always try to do in all my approaches, aging doesn't look all that bad. And I've lectured a good deal on aging, and I always describe all the things that happens to one when one ages, and some of them I'll talk about today. So I go down the list, you know, and not very much of it is good. But there is one overwhelming compensation. There's a great increase in wisdom with age, and that sort of overwhelms and overcomes all the others. In fact, while I think of it, there is some, and I may refer to it later. There's a good deal of information that is not correct relative to aging. A lot of people say, well, you lose a lot of neurons. And that's why when you get to be my age, you forget things and fumble around and stuff. Well, the truth of the matter is, in some intelligence tests and tests for capability of learning a lot of old people have come out better than young when you test them out. See, a lot of the data on loss of cells and other things are based on people who were very ill. They didn't test it on the people that were well. And so there's some recent information that indicates and vindicates this. And you have a lot of paradigms on this. One of the more active members of our faculty at Washington State University, one of the more delightful people, I'm just organizing now a great big party. He doesn't know it. His name is Arthur Vitums. He was one of the distinguished anatomists in Europe. It's one of the good things the Lutheran Church did. They brought over a lot of displaced persons, Latvians, Estonians, and if there's ever a sad story, it's the story of those countries when the Russians took them over. Last night you sang Waterfall, that song of the waterfall, you know. Well, that was written by Ivar Ivask, yeah. He was here. He tried to teach us how to write poetry. I wrote one poem. It's the only poem I can remember. And it was published in the Holden News or something. And he probably disclaimed that he ever had me as a pupil. But that was his first writing in English of poetry when he was here. He and his wife. And it's now a song here, and a very beautiful song. I was telling you about Arthur Vitums, a great anatomist, and we do a terrible, terrible thing with our old people, it's a great concern of mine. In the case of him, when I came back to Washington State University, I'd consulted him a good deal after I left school about important matters on anatomy and other things, and when I got back to back there, they had retired him, although he came to work every day. He works every day, maybe not a full day. He's still publishing, but you see, you couldn't pay him anything because it would compromise his retirement, except they didn't give him enough to retire. His retirement wasn't enough to live on, really. It's just really crazy. And so we formed a regional program in veterinary medicine. So I arranged that University of Idaho could pay him. That didn't compromise his retirement from Washington State University. And now they finally became enlightened. And now a retired person on our faculty, you can pay him up to 40% of his retirement salary without compromising his retirement after he retires. So now I have him on a stipend. But anyway, I arranged so he could go to meetings, and he's still giving papers, and he'll be 75 this spring. I just had a letter from Joel Hildebrand. Joel Hildebrand, I met him when I was at the University of California, Davis. Before I even went to the University of California, Davis, they had some people in and some speakers at a big conference, and I was one of them. Joel Hildebrand, and I met him then, and then I knew his son, who was one of the outstanding teachers at the University of California, David. Joel Hildebrand's a chemist, and we happened to take the wine tour together, and I'd heard about him, and so I got to know him on this trip a bit, and I wanted to use him as an example in my lectures. Joel Hildebrand is 97, and his wife is 91 or 3. They've been married for, I forgot now, I wish I would have brought the letter, delightful letter he wrote me. He's still lecturing at the University of California. He still climbs the stairs, and he's still publishing, and I got to remember to bring that letter next time. And he sort of gave me some philosophy on why he's still able to do this, and he feels that part of it is a long and happy married life contributed a great deal to this. And that will become evident also in here. But it's a really delightful letter, and he's still really sharp as can be. And while I think about examples, I didn't plan it this way, but I'm also reminded of Oscar Johnson, who I was delighted to meet. He was sort of a relative of a relative. I'd known about him a long time. He was a Swede raised over here in Western Washington. He went to Stanford Medical School, graduated in 1918, and worked on malaria control in Sacramento Valley, and then he set up practice in Sacramento. And his wife died with cancer, and he raised 3 girls pretty much from the time they were quite young, and did a good job of it. And he also had a big practice. I know before I left California in 79 or 80, he was still making house calls. And he had some patients that were over 100 years old, although he hadn't been their doctor for a long time. So I saw a good deal of him, and I'd have him over for things, and I discussed this issue with him, and I'll be discussing some things that one does when one gets old, but I'll tell you about him now, some of this, because he said that one of the things that he feels keeps him sharp is, he started the journal club at Sutter Hospital, which is one of the best hospitals in Sacramento, and it's every Thursday, I think it is, every Wednesday, because I remember I always used to try to, I said, I'm coming over, can we have lunch together? And he said, well, that's my journal club, where they review the latest information in the latest journals. But the other thing he does, he reads Swedish, and it would be a lot better if he read Norwegian, but he reads Swedish every Sunday afternoon, just to keep up. He also memorizes something every week. He feels that's the way he keeps his mind going. You've got to use it. And he memorized it maybe in German or maybe in some foreign language or this. And he also started a retirement home right in the middle of Sacramento. He had some of my same philosophy on this. So if you're going to have a retirement home, you have it next to, between a kindergarten and a zoo. When I get to be dictator, that's what I mean. if in fact you have to have them. But that's Oscar's philosophy. And the other one is, you never go to fatigue, and you always keep warm. I have maybe more to say about that. I'm kind of nut. I'm a real nut about warmth, and that's one of the things I really worry about. You know, the average Social Security take this. I right now, I suppose in America it's probably something just over 2,000 a year or something. I mean, it's something terrible. And now we're on a big energy crisis. And people have to set their thermometers at 65. Some people will be going less than this. And one of the hazards for old people is hypothermia. It's a very hazardous thing, and below 65, that's a very high probability. Now some of this may not be useful to you, but it's important to me to talk about this as to how one expresses. In biology, we like to, although we can appreciate curves, biologists appreciate curves. They like straight lines. They compare, you like straight lines. And so we use curves to kind of express this. And two of the ways we express mortality and other things to compare them is first this way, which is the normal survival curve, and on the
on the ordinance here, you express percent survivors of, with time or age, you see. And if there's a given percentage dying at every age, you have this kind of a curve. But if it's it's something where you don't have you have very low mortality early, and then most of it at the end, this is more representative, and so that's one way of expressing mortality. The other way one is Gompertz's plot. In 1825, a guy named Gompertz, I think he was working in a brewery or something, and he became very interested. He was a mathematician. Now this is kind of a lousy slide, but I want to talk from it because it kind of summarizes some of the things I want to say. And I owe some of this, well, to a fellow named Hardin Jones from the University of California. He made quite a study of this, but then he was going to change the whole drug situation. He died with a heart attack not too long ago. But he had quite a philosophy on this, and what he did, what Hardin Jones did was to look at a lot of statistics on disease history of a lot of people or injuries and accidents. And he also took a Guggenheim or something, and he looked at most of the countries in Europe to see how they lived, and also got their statistics on lifespan and so forth. And then he looked at a lot of other aspects. And well, I probably should show you this before I show you that. As one looks at the present sea, this is a Gompertz plot. And what it says, it sounds imposing, but Gompertz, what it says is your chances of dying increases as you get older. It isn't fully true, because when you're young, your chances are also pretty good, and it used to be really great, really good. I mean, there's a high death rate early in life. And in the countries such as India, the death rate is still very high, 10 per 1,000 people per year, sort of. And that's the India curve for the mortality curve with age. And this is Sweden. And you have very low mortality. And another interesting thing about this, as one examines this, you can say, well, nature. Nature was most interested in preserving and conserving in the area of reproductive age, right? The lowest mortality is in the reproductive age. It's also at a time physiologically when your neuroendocrine and your immune system is working best. It doesn't really fully develop probably until you're 15, and then it starts going to pot when you get to be 30 and 40, you see, for some people. Some of it still works, fortunately. But that's sort of the expression. Now what Hardin Jones did in sort of summarizing much of what we're going to say is that this is age down here, and this is the mortality, 1 per 100,000, 10 to 100 and 1,000. And for much of your life, it's a fairly straight line. And let us say this is Sweden. Let's say it's somebody in Sweden, which, and it's usually a woman in Sweden has probably the longest life. We read a lot about today about certain populations that have a very long half life. They go to these very remote places, and they interview these people who are 140 years old, and there's a few characteristics of them. They're always in a remote place. They live a very simple life. It's a hard life. They work hard all their life, and most of them are literate, and they lie about their age. That's the characteristic. Now, what Hardin Jones did was to say, all right, and he was interested in radiation as I was. But he looked at a lot of other things. And most everything you do in life moves you up on another line. It puts you up on another line, you see, above where the Swedish woman is, right? If you smoke one pack a day for much of your life, you're on another line that puts you up here dying sooner. I suppose one pack will do about 8 to 10 years you'll die 8 to 10 years sooner. Two packs a day, probably up to 15 to 20 years, you lose off your life. If you're 20% overweight, that takes another 8 to 10 years probably off. These are in round numbers now. If you live in the city, that's worth another 5 or 8 years on a new line. If you, what was that?
You marry a Norwegian?
No, if you're married, if you're not married, you're on a new line up here. And when he said that, I told him my observation was, it depends on who you marry. And so it goes. And what it ends up with saying is this. If you're a bachelor living in Brooklyn, 20% overweight, smoking two packs a day, you'll probably die 35 years sooner than a woman living in rural Sweden who has children and is also married. That's what he says here. And the other thing about it that has been observed by him and others is that if you quit smoking, especially down here, you will assume a new line. You'll drop down to another line. In other words, there is repair. So that's some of the gist of that. And we'll just go through some of these. Now, and it's interesting to look at a lot of things. And something that's probably self-evident to you. If you plot now, going back to the survival curve, survivorship, that whether you're a cockroach, a Drosophila, an automobile, a mouse, or a person, that's typical survival curve, unless you have high mortality early in life. But that's the typical curve for all of these. You just adjust the age down here. So we have a lot of similarity with other things and other animals. And another thing that I want to point out, and this doesn't show so well here to make my point, because this is an idealized curve, and this was for very, very early. But I'm going to, let's look at that. And what has happened is that, well, even Mexico today, you'll have a high mortality early in life. You see it here? You see you're on this line. And the percent survivor, there's only about a 60% survival by 10 years of age. That's what that tells you. So in India, it's somewhere there. And this is sort of like Stone Age Man early on. And you can see UK and USA in 1900. You see, they're on a new curve compared with us at this time, or this is 1965. We haven't really improved it much since 1965. But they made a mistake when they did this, because this curve is really probably should come like this, because, and to make the point, but it's also true, that you see, maximum lifespan through all this time is all there. The number of people, I mean, the maximum age that one lives hasn't really changed much. Okay? It really hasn't. No matter what we have done, and we've done a lot of things to improve the health of people all this time, what we have done is reduced infant mortality, so more people are surviving. All right? But we have not extended the lifespan. And I think that's an important concept to realize. Here's the curve I drew, which is probably more realistic. And what we have done has gone through many years, and we've improved it, but the ideal is up above there. You like to live a very active life and then have your heart quit one evening in your sleep. And that's what my wife wants. Her chances are doing that, however, are not very great, because I'll never forget my conversation with Sir John Hammond, who was one of the outstanding animal scientists in England. And he and we discussed this one time many years ago on how one ensures a long lifespan. He says, "Well, I'll tell you what old Dr. Pearl told me in 1908. To ensure a long lifespan, you pick a mother with a long lifespan." And neither of us could do anything about that. But what are you trying to make a point of? Probably your lifespan is probably at least maybe 30% genetics. Maybe it's more than that. But there's a lot to it. And then, of course, a lot of it depends on how you take care of it and accidents and things. And there's a big argument today of whether there is an aging process independent of disease and accidents that impinge on this. And many people say, well, there probably isn't, because any change even in the molecular structure of our cells and all can be interpreted as disease, you see. But we know, and in answer to the question that we posed here about do we start dying the minute we're born, well, in a way we do. My cells in my intestines and the cells in a baby's intestines have a turnover time, some of them, of probably one day. The cells are dying. And in our blood cells, some of them only last a few days. Red cells in people, I guess they're around 120 days, and half of them are gone. So there's a lot of cells. Our epidermal turnover time is I don't know, 30 days or something, maybe less, depending on what you're doing. If you expose them to terrible things like sun and other bad things, then it's worse. And they probably turn over faster, and you have a higher incidence of cancer of the skin. People speak of a healthy tan. That's not the right adjective. It's an unhealthy tan. And I can prove it. So the thymus gland, for example. The thymus gland is very large in the young, but it's pretty much all gone by the time they're in advanced adolescence. And there are various programs in some of our systems where they're essentially, it just goes so far and that's it. And then you go to you progress to something else. Certainly to our, well, it's most evident in females in the reproductive system, isn't it? So we have these kind of cycles in life in which there are cells programmed for a certain length of time. And I started to tell you about cellular loss in the central nervous system. They say, well, you're losing 1,000 cells every day. Well, the truth of the matter is, in certain areas, I and you are not losing cells at all. But in certain other areas of our central nervous system, we are. And I may hit this later. Some cells have hardly any turnover time, and that's true of our central nervous system. It's true for some of our glands. The thyroid gland has cells that last for a long, long time. So we have this great difference in our cells, in our body. And our bone turns over. It's surprising to some of you. Some of you women know this because you have unfortunate suffer many from osteoporosis. And then you break limbs very easily. And there's something we have to do something about, and some people are working on this. And I just plotted this morning. These are deaths per 100,000 at each age, and you see that the chances of getting these various things increases, and I talked about this the other day. And most deaths, I suppose over the deaths from cardiovascular disease and associated things, atherosclerosis and all, is over 50% of all deaths, and it's more than cancer and stroke, diabetes, and kidney disease and liver disease combined, probably. And you see that, and the chances for this increases with age in all of the ones I have mentioned here: hypertension, malignant neoplasms, cancer, arteriosclerotic heart disease, and cardiovascular and renal diseases. So that's sort of the story there. And you don't need that. Now, to make an important point here, I have spent a good deal of my life in biological research, where I was involved with the lifespan of the animals: sheep, pigs, dogs, and mice. Mice, it's a little easier because I think one of my mice lived longer than almost any other mice in recorded literature. Somebody else got credit. They always cite Elizabeth Russell, and she had a 1,320-day mouse. I had a 1,345-day mouse. That's pretty long. And mine shouldn't have lived as long as hers because mine were males living alone. but I also had them at a rather high temperature. You see, a lot of people keep their mouse colonies at the comfort index of people. I kept mine at what I call thermic neutrality. That is at a temperature when they do not have to either expend energy to heat themselves or to cool themselves. And that's at about 83 degrees for a mouse, if you're interested. I'm disturbed that so many people are worried about mice. They're really kind of a lovable animal. And they really don't eat much, and especially these little white-footed mice here. They're really a remarkable species. The Paramyscus they'll live three times as long as a house mouse. Their brain's bigger, and in fact, the lifespan is related to brain size in the various species. I know there's a few down in our house, down in number one, and I was watching one of them today. It was enjoying life, and boy, it's remarkable. You know, I'm always impressed how they can climb a fireplace. It's like nothing. Gretchen and I were watching him, and he was enjoying life and went in and disappeared into the heater later there. So I don't want anybody to start a furnace fire start a fireplace fire in number one here this morning. So don't get to worry about mice. But I told you I dealt with some of these, and this happens to be dogs, and it shocks a lot of people because people get very worried when people do experiments, as we were doing on long-term colonies of dogs. We took very good care of our dogs, and in the early experiments, my associates arranged for some of the dogs, the surplus dogs, to be put out to people who would really take good care of them and let us know how long they lived and everything. And half of the dogs that we lent out to people who took good care of them were dead after 4 or 5 years. Half of ours were still alive at 13. That tells you something you already knew, that things are tough on the outside. It tells you another thing, that accidents take a lot of... It also takes the curve on the number of pedestrians killed is pretty much also on dogs. You'll have a high incidence of loss from as a pedestrian early in life. That's true for people. And then late in life, we're not inattentive. There's all kinds of times I could have been run over because I get concentrating on something and I just walk out in the street. And if there'd been a car there, it'd run over me. And that's the more so as you get older because you have more on your mind. At least that's my excuse. You can think up your own. So that's interesting. So accidents do take it. These are the cumulative survival rate from our 10 dogs versus our field dogs, and the field dogs didn't do well. Where ours in the pens, they had a very long life. Some of them are still there at the University of California. Some of them are pushing 18 now, and an 18-year-old dog is like 90. I may have a slide on that. Now, but there are certain diseases that impinge on this, and that's the big argument. There isn't one disease that you can say, well, here's the limiting case. We don't have that. For some, it's the heart. For some, it's the kidneys. And we can go into a lot of these. This is interesting in animals, and my pitch, of course, is animals. What do we learn from animals that will help people? And here are our gray horses versus thoroughbreds. And you can say the grays die sooner. And one of the limiting cases in a gray, of all the gray and white horses I know, by the time they're 16, 80% of them have melanoma, tumor of the melanin, the pigment. And so that probably contributes to them. It's a kind of an unusual case. And here's another interesting thing we haven't been able to explain, but some people are like this. Maybe they got progeria or something. We have situations in people like progeria, which is premature aging. I can show you some children that are 8 to 15 years old that are just like an 80-year-old person. They're all wrinkled and they just have premature aging. So they're of course a subject of great interest for the gerontologists. But here are spaniels that show a pretty good survival curve. You know, you like to have a rectangular curve. Wolfhounds, like Irish wolfhounds, or there's also a Russian wolf song that's called something else. But it's almost a certain percentage of them dying all the time. And we don't know why, but they, of course, are interesting to study.
But generally two hounds are just those two.
Yeah, well, that's most typical there. The curve, however, on the old dogs is that the small dogs like the poodles and sort of cocker spaniel cocker scandals like our dog Charlie, terriers and beagles and others, they live much longer than the big dogs, like Saint Bernards. Labrador, like your Labrador Retriever, you see, it'll be old at 10. And you don't see very many Labrador Retrievers that are 12 and 13. And I have never seen any 15 or 16. Now, there might be some. We've removed mammary carcinomas on poodles at 16. And they still have some survival. Now it's interesting. Now, some of this, dogs are kind of mixed up because a lot of people, because of the competition for dog shows, they breed into them some things that aren't necessarily good for their health. For conformation, they might have gone to more hip dysplasias and more stupidity and other things. Now, and to show you the great difference, like in mice. Now, mice, of course, have been bred. If you want a mouse today that has a 50% incidence of mammary tumors at the age of 15 months, I can probably get it for you as a shelf item out of Jackson Lab. Or if you want one that's very resistant to radiation and shows very few tumors with radiation, I can get you one of those. If you want one that has is very sensitive to radiation, I can get you one of those. If you want one that will that only half of them will be killed by 700 R or rad of radiation, I can get you one of those. If you want some that are killed by 150 rad of radiation, I can get you one of those. And I can get you low and high incidence of various tumors because it's genetically determined to a great part, and we have them as shelf items. And they vary a lot in lifespan. The death rate with age, you see here. Here's five different species, and this one has a very short short life, doesn't it? You see, only 500-700 days, and they're old. And we have some out here that really live a long time, you see, as possibility. And here's Poodle paramiscus. These are these white-footed mice that run around sort of field mice, and they might live three times as long as a lot of the house mice. And they'll be with you for, so treat them well, you know, give them a place to live and so let them go out in the winter or summer again. And they're really a neat animal, and it's interesting that their brain weight is almost it's much larger than these out here. A friend of mine named Sacher at the University of Argonne National Laboratory, he's this year's president of the Gerontological Society. Did that work. He's really hot for paramiscus. I don't know why this is here, but a lot of times you get asked, how long do the animals live? I've already given it to you for mice. That's a good conversation piece for you. And at the parties you go to, and tell them about paramiscus, you see. Elephants, we don't know, but we know quite a few of them, like in zoos, that live over 60 years of age. Animals are a very remarkable animal. I don't know if you've ever watched him. I spent some time at it, and I know when one of the first one was born at Portland Zoo, the first baby, I got a special birth announcement from him, so I had to go down and see him. And they have a remarkable society. Before the offspring is born, the mother picks an auntie that is sort of the midwife. And always then they try to keep the little one between them, and it helps protect them. And if one of them is away, the other one will not let it lay down. And I know when I was down there, I was in the pen with him, and the little one, he was really, he's playful like any small creature, and he came running over to us, and they shifted around to get him between them, you know, and then they blew hay on me. And it was really funny because I didn't know, you know, I hadn't realized, because we came in the back way. And we were there, and they were throwing straws, and we were playing with them. And suddenly I felt like somebody was watching. And I happened to look up, and we were sort of in the display cage, and here all these people were watching. So we got out of there. But they're very interesting beasts. And that's one of our problems, because as they expand in numbers, and this is something beside aging, I realize, but... they're really fascinating, but one of the problems with it is that, so you're going to thin them out, because if you get too many, boy, they really tear up the Serengeti Plain. And I was out there not long ago, and boy, they can rip the trees up, you know. And so what you do then to kind of balance out the biota, huh? Well, you thin them out. But that isn't really a very good way, because they mourn so much. It's so disturbing to people to see this. So now they one of the things they did in one place was to go in with some really good marksmen with really high-powered rifles, and to a whole group then, they destroy the whole group, rather than to thin them that way, rather than select some out of the herd. It really tears you up. There was a story where a lot of people had collected up a whole bunch of bones and tusks and stuff from some elephants. Some of them, I guess, had been shot, and they had them in this house. And some elephants came and took them all away. You never want to underestimate what's going on in the noggin of some of these animals. Now, we have horses that live up 50 or more years. Recently, there was a mare who gave birth at, I think, 32. So that kind of shook some people up. Baboons, we don't know a lot of these. Whales probably live a very long time. And whales are a very remarkable animal, too. If you haven't read it, you want to read in National Geographic the communication system of some of these whales. It'll blow your mind. And they change the tune from one year to the next. It's very involved. And fish, some of the halibut and sturgeon, some of the birds. If some of you shot a Canadian geese, you know it was probably at least 47 years old. Because the more you chewed and the more you spit out, the more you had in your mouth. Parrots live a long time. Tortoise is probably the longest life of the animals. So that gives you some feel for that, which is kind of fun. What else have I got? Now, one of the interests of many people is, how can I live longer? And there has been some work in rats, and this is always cited, and I hesitate to put too much time into this, because so much has been written on this, and I'm getting sort of tired of it. And all it pretty much says to me is that if you're a rat, and if you starve a rat for the first 1,000 days of its life, you can probably double its lifespan. Well, if you give a rat the choice, it probably... may not make that choice, because it may just seem like it's a long life. But they have actually done this, and here's the normal diet. You can give them what they want to eat, or if you restrict their diet, all you're doing is preventing them from maturing. You see, and if you can keep them from maturing, and then you bring them, and you can't do that for over 900 days, because then some very unfortunate things happens to them. And they might go blind and things like that. But you can take it out that long, and then you feed them to a full blow, and then they'll live out sort of a normal lifespan. So essentially you've sort of doubled it, providing you keep them healthy otherwise. Well, I don't know what that does for it, because rats don't grow like we do. They'll keep growing and growing for a long time. Their epiphyses do not close for a long time, see. So I don't know if it says anything to it. Although it does say this, that we would probably be a lot healthier if we didn't eat as much, if we ate less, and I think this is one of the mistakes we make with children. When I was growing up, everybody said, "Boy, isn't that a nice, healthy baby?"
And it had rolls of fat on it, you know. And essentially doing that, boy, you feed them all it get. All it takes, see. I think that's a mistake. Because you essentially establish a pattern for a lot of things before you're 6 years old or 8 years old. All kinds of patterns are established by then. A lot of your whole behavior, how your eating habits, and also your attitude, for example, to animals. And there have been quite a few studies to show this, that there's at least two times in your life when animals are probably most meaningful to you and most helpful, and that's early in life and late in life. And you're robbing the people of something late in life because they've never had a dog or a cat and they don't want one, where in reality it would make all the difference in the world to them at that time. And if you don't believe me, you can get the tape on animal facilitated therapy, and I think you'll be convinced, as many have, and there's data to prove it. But this is high and low calorie stuff, so in rats, and I just wanted to tell you that, but only to make the point that it probably doesn't have that much applicability to a lot of other animals, but it does make the point that we do eat too much, and that you're setting pattern early in life, and we shouldn't feed our children so much early in life, and we don't need all we eat, but it's well we eat a balanced meal. But I should also say that the data that I just received within the last few months in a conference of some of the experts at the Aging Institute showed that with old people, there is a lower mortality of those old people who are mildly overweight versus those who are thin like me. So maybe that'll make you feel better. So that, you know, on the radio, pinch and an inch, you know, it's a good thing. Now, on performance, this is very important in animals, but and this we here we are plotting the mean weight of the calves from the mean weight of the cow, their calves are smaller than the later ones. And then after you pass a certain age, then it decreases again. One's efficiency of production, and this is also true with people, there is a time when it's better than other times. And this is true for those of you who raise dogs, for example. And the size of the average litter size, or egg production, or calves. You see that it starts out and it goes up and then comes back down. Except in egg production, and that's why they don't keep hens around too long. You know, it's that first or second year and then they start all over. Or the mean weight of calves, it goes up and then it starts coming down. So those of you who are interested in things like that, and we did studies on litters in pups, and you see up here that the number of pups weaned in a litter is like this. The first litter is, they usually don't do so very well, at least many of the animals don't, and the number of young per litter is also less than later, and then it falls off with time. And that's why people usually discourage in the human population of having children too late in life or too early in life. Now, there are a lot of theories in aging. And whenever there's a lot of theories, you know that we haven't figured it out. or they're interrelated. And there's a lot of scientists who, boy, this is my theory, and they'll defend it to the end, and another one is over here. And a lot of them are not mutually exclusive. Some of them, you know, there's parts of them that obtain. And so we might run through a few of these. Metchnikoff said that what really happens in when you get old, and he's an old Russian, and he said this in the 1800s. He says what happens is in your metabolism and your digestion. What happens? You collect up a lot of toxins, and the bacteria produce a lot of toxins in your digestive tract, and these accumulate, and it just gets to a certain point where there's just too many, and the sort of things go to pot. And one of the things that he proposed then was to drink Bulgarian buttermilk.
to change the flora of your GI tract. And that's why many of you drink Bulgarian buttermilk or used to. And that's why my wife still drinks buttermilk, and that's why she looks 10 years younger than I am, even though she's older. And I only drink it once a week, or I use it when I make flatbread every week. I use buttermilk in my flatbread. But they cited as examples. You know, they go down into southern Russia and show you all these old people. They drink this acidophilus milk, and boy, they were really old. But what I said earlier still obtains. Most of them didn't know how old they were. They probably just looked old, out in the sun as much as they did, and all wrinkled, but they drink acidophilus. I'm not knocking it. I think good old sour milk and buttermilk is all right if you can take it. And I sort of like it. But it probably isn't... A big reason why you age. There is change in a lot of structure in collagen, some of your connective tissue. We can prove that there is a change with time. I don't know how much this contributes. Somebody else says there's a fixed reserve that you use up so many calories and then brother or sister you've had it. I may come back to this, so I better leave this out. And one fellow did this, Rubner, I think his name was, and he took all these animals, and just ignore man for now, and he found out that no matter whether it was a small animal or a large animal, he determined what their calories expended during their lifetime per kilogram body weight, or per 100 grams of body weight. He found out it was very near the same. Like a mouse is charging around and it's really busy and it's using up a lot of calories per gram, while some of the animals, other animals, big animals are slow, and so they're using up less, and so they live longer. But when the chips are finally down, they've all used about the same. And that sort of makes a case for, well, maybe you, there is a certain amount, and then you've used up maybe some of the enzymes that have a programmed life or something, and that's the way it is. Except in the case of people, they were about four times as long. And some of this is related to the control systems. And it's related also to the size of the brain per body weight. So we do have a remarkable control system that probably relates to this. And it's interesting, and probably good at times as any, one of the very active people in this, and I had him as a consultant many, many years ago, Caleb Finch, University of Southern California. He's one of the authorities on aging in the country. He's done a lot of work with rats and mice. And he was one of those fellows that helped blow the thesis that, you're losing cells in the central nervous system everywhere. And he has isolated this to only a few areas, the basal ganglion and a few other places in the brain. In certain control centers, there's where the cell loss is with life, during life. And he's also shown... Some of you have seen, or you have relatives that have Parkinson's, isn't right? And there's a certain cell loss in the brain, in a certain area of the brain, with this. And one of the reasons that we had quite a large amount of it is, it was probably associated with the big flu epidemic. When some of these viruses from the flu viruses attacked this area of the brain. And so these cells died sooner. But these cells do die, and it seems to be related then to the number of cell loss as to whether you sort of go this way or not. And it's also true in his mouse colony that in the same area, this varies, but there's a cell loss in the same area and with this deterioration. So that's a very fascinating thing, that there's certain areas, and he is one that feels, you know, there's sort of a clock going on. It's a clock that sort of determines this. It's related... Certainly you can make the case for reproduction. Maybe it's also related to immunology. And you're not as resistant to disease as you grow older, so more of these things get you. And that can almost be a sort of a programmed thing. So that's kind of an interesting theory, and he's doing some very interesting things about it. Other people have proposed that there is a clock. Gene mutation and chromosome damage. I'll show you a slide later to show you how that works, because and in this, of course,
I made quite a pitch on this, and I'm really keen about this, that we're all unique. No one, we're all different. Partly due to genetics, due to genetics that we're all different, but we've all had different experiences. And what my hope is that we will advance in biomedical sciences to the extent that we do treat everyone individually. And we are able to profile them and say, well, your diet should be this, but not, you should have a different diet. You should have probably this program of activity and physical activity, and you should have this, you see. And so we can program to then utilize your capabilities to the fullest. Right now, we're not there. For some of you, as I mentioned the other day, rye bread is great for you. To me, it's like almost poison, and that's true with a lot of foods. For some of you, you may not be able to handle fats. Others of you can. Some of you shouldn't be taking salt. Others can probably use normal salt and not affect you, you see. But we haven't profiled everybody like this. And some of you can't, like Bill there, he is probably doesn't do so well with vitamin C, and he requires higher amounts of vitamin C than some people. Some people maybe need higher E. Most recently, vitamin B6. Some people think that it's the primary. The lack of this might be very much involved in the first lesion to start out the whole program of atherosclerosis. That a deficiency of that. So if you have enough B6, maybe it'll counteract some of that. You see. So we all have these differences in our chemistry. We all recognize it as we look around this room. We're all different, aren't we? It's the same with our biochemistry and a lot of other things, and how we react to various things. So we must keep that in mind. And as one sees, there is a remarkable control system for our body. As you get into it, you have to be amazed at the complexity of it and how it works. That it works as well as it does is almost unbelievable. To run a system like we have, it would take a computer that would be almost beyond your comprehension. It is truly, it was a good architect on the job. This is part of this, the homeostatic disturbance, that is, what keeps us sort of running right, even we have all kinds of different stimuli that it does function. Part of this is related to hormones. And then we have some people say your immune system changes so that your immune system, where it doesn't attack itself. Maybe later in life it does attack some things. You see, it doesn't recognize self. So these are some of the theories on aging, and that isn't very good, and that isn't necessary. This is an interesting thing on some mice, and probably applies to all kinds of other things. Some people have more sensitive chromosomes than others. They're more subject to damage. And this is the case with these two strains of mice, you see. And if you look at this plot, and you'll see that arrow there, that's the mean age lifespan of that animal versus the mean lifespan of this one. You see, this strain lives much longer than this one. And the percent chromosome aberrations one sees in its tissues or in its cells is far different, isn't it? This is only at the same time here, they have 20% chromosome aberrations in a certain population of cells where they have, it's really 20, about over three times as many, you see. Well, people are sort of like that, you see. Some of you have tough chromosomes and some have not so tough chromosomes. Now, that's about all I'm going to tell you about that, and then I just want to summarize as to how I see the state of the knowledge today, and as a result of that, what I am doing. See, and what I'm doing for myself may not apply to you. You see what I mean? But I have made this plea for that you recognize uniqueness, and I'm working at the end where we hope that biomedical science will advance. That we do get to the point where we can profile people well, and that each one is recognized as an individual. We don't do that today, do we? I mean, well, it's an average sort of a thing, and here's what you do for them, and it's 5 minutes in, and here's what your profile looks like. Your cholesterol is there, and your and your triglycerides are there, and that's sort of within the normal range, you better cut down on this and that. And what I'm saying for myself may not apply to you. It's very important for me that I get some exercise every day. And I can make a case for exercise. I ride a bike or I walk to work and back. And if you've ever been in Pullman, the hills are pretty steep. And if you have a two-speed bike, I have a three-speed bike, but only two speeds work. And it's a challenge, you know. I'm panting like an Airedale when I get to the top of that hill, especially with my pack on my back. And if my tires aren't that full of air. So I do, and it's important there for me, and sometimes I stop at the top of the hill not only to rest, but to check my pulse rate to see how it is, because it's important if you get 20 to 30 minutes where your pulse rate does go up to maybe double, somewhere, and it depends on what your pulse rate is going, 120, 150. So that's one. Now, why do I exercise? Because it makes me feel better, and exercise has been shown to keep your pipes more open. Your coronary vessels. For people who do exercise, their coronary vessels have a larger radius or diameter. And there's also some indication that it does increase the mitochondria and their assault on the fat stores. There is also some indication, and now we don't know whether this is after the fact or not, that exercise does increase the high density lipid in your blood. For a long time ago, they said, well, cholesterol is bad. Well, all the work isn't in on that, and a lot of people who have low cholesterol might have a heart attack, and those with high may not. There is some association, however, and it isn't good to eat a lot of fat, whether, no matter what kind it is. But now we find out that some cholesterol is tied to the high-density lipid. That's good cholesterol, because there's a chance that this high-density lipid goes in there and removes cholesterol and excretes it. It's the low-density lipid, or the very low-density lipid, that's the bad part. And it's the one that sort of is involved in depositing it. And related to this is hypertension. And if you have high blood pressure, you're going to have more, in a given situation, with a given cholesterol level, you're going to have more deposits of atherosclerosis or calcific plaques in your vessels. And hypertension, and that we've been able to control it in the last 10 years rather remarkably with drugs. And it's very important. I can't emphasize enough. I watch my blood pressure because some of my family has had high blood pressure. Although my father's heart was still, and his vasculature were very good in his 80s. Not so much with my mother. But I have to watch that. For some of you, you may not have to watch that. But I watch my fat intake. However, I think we have been sold a bill of goods in recent times relative to saturated and unsaturated fat. As some of you know, the saturated fat intake, or the animal fat intake since 1910 has decreased in the United States. The vegetable fat intake has increased threefold. And there's been a big increase in trans fatty acids because that's what you use to hydrogenate a lot of these things with. And it's handled differently than the normal cis fatty acid. And I'm not so sure if trans fatty acid isn't bad news, because I can cite data for you that shows, for example, corn oil may well be a co-carcinogen. And trans fatty acid is proven I have papers back in 1942 with Tannenbaum showed that hydrogenated cottonseed oil was carcinogenic in animals. It contributed to increase in cancer. This is what you see in margarines and things like that. And it may also not do that much for the cholesterol in the blood, if in fact that's a hazard. But it's a good idea to keep, I love to keep my cholesterol down. And some people think that maybe 220 is the break point. It'd be nice to keep it under 200. And that's a goal. And I don't eat all that much meat, but lean beef and lamb is things I take some. I don't usually put very much butter at all. I don't use margarine, I use butter, but not very much. And I already mentioned my exercise and my hypertension. I mean, to watch hypertension. And you can learn to take your own, you know. and I promoted as a member of the aging council in Pullman, we have clinics where you can get your blood pressure taken. But I can't emphasize that enough. And salt. I've cut down on my salt intake. Now, for some of you, it doesn't probably make much difference. As in some animals, like rats, I can drive a bunch of rats into hypertension like nothing flat, just giving them rather high amounts of salt. I can take another group of rats, and I can feed them a lot of salt, and it doesn't make any difference, see? So there is a difference in people, too, as to salt. And you can get used to less salt. Our son is a very good cardiologist. We visited him not time ago, and I couldn't find any salt in the house. And that did tell me something. So you like we heard this morning from Ed, you know, you got to practice what you preach. That's I guess that's about where I am on this. And the other thing is I try to stay very active. I always got a lot of irons in the fire, and I'm always one of the most interesting things to me is the gaining of new knowledge. You've got to keep interested. You can't spend your time in front of the boob tube getting bigger and bigger waffle butts and smaller minds. That is not the way to go. Not to say that some of them aren't good. The Muppets are good. That's a challenging thing. That's a real test of a person, whether he watches Muppets and the great sex symbol of the world is my favorite Miss Piggy. And then Washington Week in Review. But there aren't very many. Well, there's some good plays. But a lot of it's worthless. You got to be at something and gaining new knowledge, maybe memorizing things and remaining active. And my observations, and I can name you a lot of other old people, like when I was at the University of California, like old Storr. I went over to see him. I was going to go over to see him because he was having an operation on his eyes, and he was very distressed at this. I was going over to talk to him because he couldn't be keeping up on the latest literature. And he always showed up at seminars at 83. He'd cycle in on his bike. So I guess that's my pitch for you today.